Welcome
to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing the explorations of the cultures of consciousness. I still remember one of the more powerful intellectual and spiritual initiations I got in my life from reading books, which was the encounter with the works of James Hillman. And James Hillman, a somewhat renegade Jungian therapist, introduced me, or sort of reintroduced me, to one of the pivotal distinctions you find in the Western Hermetic magical tradition, which is the difference, in his language, between spirit and soul. And in our modern world, we often think of, like, there's just, I mean, if we're even using words like soul, that there's the big differences between the body and the soul. There are these two things. But in the tradition that I was introduced to through Hillman, there's really three elements. There's the body, and then there's the spirit, that sort of angel stuff of kind of spiritual transcendence, the crystal rays of the higher realms. And then in between these is the realm of the soul, the realm of psyche, of dreams, of desires, of fantasies, of pathologies, of memories, traditions, gods whispering in your ear, poems, et cetera, et cetera. And that this was a different component of the self, and that a lot of spiritual people get confused in mixing the two and thinking that spirit and soul are the same thing. And this was incredibly revelatory to me, as well as the idea that this realm of soul could be cultivated and practiced in a way that, well, as we'll talk about today, might resemble religion or overlap with certain aspects of traditional religion, but in many ways was an activity kind of on one's own, something that you were responsible for, and that had a great deal of similarity with the way in which we cultivate art in our lives, or pleasure, or camaraderie, and that this work of cultivation was really valuable, and I really took that to heart in my personal space, and my writing space, and my, to some degree, my clothes. Certainly the travel I do is very much influenced by the desire to create a context for this emergence of the soul as a site of deeper meaning, of play, of working out the tensions and contrasts in life. And so I'm very happy today to talk to Thomas Moore on the show. Thomas Moore has had a number of very successful books, including Care of the Souls, the most, probably the best known, and one that really took some ideas from his own work with James Hillman and brought them into a very broad context that really influenced a lot of people by bringing this discussion of the soul forward. And he's got a new book out called A Religion of One's Own. And it's a very interesting text. I found it both familiar and also challenging and new in very interesting ways, particularly as it pertains, and you know, we'll talk about this, but as it pertains to the distinction that many people make between spirituality and religion. A lot of people today consider themselves spiritual but not religious. Indeed, increasingly this category is a formal category. It's like when you fill out forms and they have, like, you know, what religion are you? And you're Catholic, Buddhist, spiritual but not religious, because we need to find a way to acknowledge the practices, the beliefs, the experiences, the identities that people have that are not secular, but they're also in some fundamentally way not religious, at least is the way that religion is traditionally understood, because people aren't going to a church, they don't have a set of particular beliefs, they're not identified with one tradition, but often with many traditions that they pick and choose from. And this is a very interesting development in the modern world. I think it says a lot about where we are as a society, a lot about what we need, what we want. And in his new book, Thomas More goes into, really looking at how we cultivate this, how we move forward in the development of religion. But he uses the word religion, which is, I think, one of the interesting things I like to talk about. But before we bring Thomas onto the show, of course, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Eric. How's it going?
Pretty good. Is there, like, a particular practice you have or things that you do that is sort of designed to kind of invite this sense of soul? I mean, I know you've read Thomas More and Tillman as well, so you're
yeah,
familiar
I
with that
totally
term.
Yeah, I totally do.
So what?
Yeah,
what is
and it? Oh, sorry, Bob. Blah blah blah. No, I totally do. And like you, I came across Thomas More's work via the Jungian route through Hillman's stuff, and I was totally delighted when I found that. You know, here were these European fellows that had figured out Taoist philosophy. For me, the cultivation of the soul practices that I do are all Taoist Qigong and Neigong techniques. And the Chinese have a distinction of what you were talking about, the difference between a spirit and a soul. They call it the Hun and the Po. And your Po is your soul. That's your animal soul. That's your anima. Your animus, it's that part of you that is connected to the earth. So that's the yin, and then the yang soul is your spirit. That's your hun. And it's like, that's kind of what most religions, I feel, focus on the spirit and then remove, you know, your body or your meat suit or your animal parts completely from the equation. But ideally, I mean, really what alchemy is you unite your hun and your po, your spirit, your animal part, and then you can be like a total person. And I feel like a lot of religions kind of leave the animal part out and then just focus on the spirit.
Exactly. Well, these are all really great questions. We want to bring Thomas on the show. Thomas, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Well, I really appreciate your inviting me, and after hearing what the both of you have just said, I feel very much at home.
That's okay. Really wonderful. It's great to talk to you. So I think I'll start out with that question I kind of set up just a moment ago, which is that I think a lot of people familiar with modern spirituality and the difference that a lot of people make in their self-descriptions between spirituality and religion, well, they'll say, well, I'm a spiritual person, but I'm really not religious, that you, kind of make the case that it's really important to think of religion as an aspect of, or a potential aspect of, spirituality, that you're not content with simply saying religion is something we need to move beyond, it's about spirituality, here's some tools for spirituality. You are still interested in the word religion, in religions, as part of this spiritual development, and I really like to hear about that. I know it has partly involves your past, but really how you think about religion in a different way as applying to these new kind of spiritual concerns.
Yes, what I say is that we don't need to abandon religion, but reimagine it. Mm. And so, what I'd like to do is stay in touch with the past. You know, the past is an aspect of soul as well. Spirit tends to move into the future. And so that soulful look at the past and being in touch with it is one reason why I stay with the word religion. I would like, in my work, like this book, I would like not to be critical of religion only, but to say that the religious traditions of the world still have so much to give us. I mean, we don't have to reinvent this thing. And I worry that this notion of spirituality is much too psychological generally in the modern sense and doesn't go deep enough. And if we remain tied to the religions of the past, to the best of it, then we are guided then toward transcendence, toward the numinous and the mysterious, which is, I'm afraid we might leave that if we only stay with spirituality.
Well, that's a really interesting way of thinking about it, but it does sort of shift what we mean by religion in the sense that I think a lot of people when they have a negative reaction or they want to step away from it, they think of it as something where you're not creatively engaged in it. You feel a bit oppressed by it. People who are raised with it feel like, hey, I didn't ask for this. I need to find my my own way. And so in order to keep the good stuff, like you're describing, that it requires a different attitude towards religion. And almost one element I see that what you're doing is to give permission to people to create a different relationship with religion, to not worry about the dark side of it entirely, but to be willing to be creative and to appropriate, to take some things that you like, to find the elements, the gods, the practices, the stories that work for you, and be okay with like plucking them out of their context and kind of bringing them into a more personal engagement. And so it's sort of almost like a kind of permission.
Yes, well, that's why I call it a religion of one's own. It's like, you know, has the echoes of Virginia Woolf, suggesting that women, but a person, any person, has to have a room of your own. It doesn't mean that you shut out everybody. It just means that you have a place to go where you are yourself. And so I think we need to do that with religion, not to make it only personal, but to appropriate it in our own way, because individually we are such different people. And we reach so deep, and we're all mysterious and to each other and to ourselves. And so I would like to see religion acknowledge that. And I want to keep the notion of religion. I realize I'm risking something when I do that. People might dismiss me for that reason, but, you know, I can't worry about that. And the other thing is, you know, I've been involved with religion all my life. I have a pretty positive attitude. And believe me, I've suffered many of the problems of the institutional religions. They're great. And so part of this work has got to be critical of those, to let people, alert people to the fact that they don't have to subject themselves to those negative aspects of formal religion. But they can, as you were saying, they can really take what they need in a deep way. Some people complain that it's the cafeteria approach. And, well, if you go deep enough into it, and whatever you take, you know, really do it seriously, you're not doing it superficially then. You're not at the cafeteria then. And then the other thing is that I have a degree, my PhD is in religion, and I loved my studies in religion. It was the most important thing in my life. So I want to keep that word.
Well, it's so pertinent, too, just because you talk about that superficiality and that cafeteria style that a lot of people will put judgments on with, you know, organized religions. But look at how the spiritualists operate. You know, they'll say and repeat a lot of things that can be found in all of the religions. Like, most of the things they do are like parodies of already deeper established traditions that, of course, are just being replayed again. So, I mean, if you look at it that way, the main role that any religion has is literally to tie us to that past, which, of course, like you said, spirit abhors. But at the same time, if we know where all of these ideas and practices and things have come from, then you get to, like you said, get into it on a deeper level, instead of just like children, right, performing these plays of spirituality at festivals and things like that, you know?
Yes. One of our problems is that we really are very sophisticated about many things in this world, through the internet especially. People know a lot, but we don't seem to know much about religion and spirituality. And so part of the work, if we're going to do this, really develop this new approach to religion that I'm suggesting, we have to do it with real intelligence and study. I'm always talking about the importance of study. One of the chapters in my book is about how we can all learn from how the monks lived as a way of being a religious person in our own way. And one of the things that the monks of all times and in all cultures have done is that they have studied. You know, they've collected libraries and translated texts and wrote commentaries and wrote their own theologies. And, you know, that takes a lot of very serious work and dedication. And I don't think that the ordinary person is aware that you can devote that kind of attention to your spiritual life. We just take what's on the surface and skim off the top. You know, we don't go deeply into it.
And that does also open up this ability to be imaginatively stimulated by the past. I mean, in a way, you can read books of history, you can read books of the development of religion, or, you know, how religious texts from quite a long time ago, and you can think of that as like trying to understand something historically, what happened in the past, what how people used to do this. But it's also an opportunity, like reading a work of literature, to be inspired, to encounter figures that haunt you, that stay in your mind, that maybe you want, and you talk about, for example, putting up poems or religious texts in your personal space, in having God forms or even idols from different traditions in your personal space, and that these are all ways of tapping into real aspects of human history, of the development of culture, but also ones that speak to you, one potentially, on a much more imaginative kind of level, that study and history and reading, they're part of this, they can be part of this process of cultivation, of cultivating a space wherein some kind of encounter can happen, even if it's an encounter with a particular God form, where suddenly you know more about it and it speaks to you and it sits on your desk and it has a sort of presence in your life. And so that seems to me it's not a conservative notion exactly, but it is an insistence that the past still matters. I mean, this is something I feel much, very much in my life, and I can see that it's different than a lot of people I know for whom the past doesn't really matter. Do you see that relationship to the past as being something that needs to be kind of fought for today, or do you see it as a sort of a natural part of any kind of rich life, is you're going to have this kind of relationship to the past?
Well, one way to get at that is to refer back to my old friend, the man you mentioned early, James Hillman. His last book is called Lament of the Dead. And there he talks about how when we acknowledge the past, like those of us who are writers, like he and I were so much alike in our writing. We were very different personalities, but we were very much alike in our work. And so he and I both were trained classically to refer to, the earlier texts. I love to translate from Latin and Greek all the time for my books. Something about that connection to the past there gives it a substance and depth that I think it wouldn't have otherwise. But he says in this new book, of his last book actually, that that quoting other people or citing them or reimagining their contributions is actually a relation to the dead. It's a presencing, like you said, it's like an encounter. So that when I write a footnote, and I always insist in my books that we have footnotes, and the publishers don't like the idea too much usually, but I insist on it, because to me those footnotes are the grave of the book, you know, the cemetery where we acknowledge the dead who have given us so much, so that when I write and refer to people like Jim now, or Hillman, or like anyone, Aristotle or Plato or the Renaissance figures I do, or writers, I'm really speaking about and to the dead. And it's an encounter then, and that is part of religion itself, to acknowledge with respect those who have gone before us and have given us so much.
It feeds the concept of immortality too, because what's that saying where you only die when the last living person says your name for the last time, right? Mm. So in a way, footnoting and including that almost in like the same way that the Jews list their, you know, patriarchal lineages, those are attempts at, through writing, to invoke a sort of immortality through these concepts and ideas and individuals that have thought them, you know?
That's right. So that is a practice of religion in itself. That's what I'm saying. The trouble is, when you hear the word religion, we are so accustomed to thinking of a big institution and some big monument or something, you know, a collection of beliefs that are written in stone. That's how we think of it. But when I use the word religion, I'm thinking of first of all, the individual's experience of mystery and of these, like, relation to the dead, like I just said. To me, to quote Hillman now, is a religious act, because that's my religion, because I'm acknowledging him directly. I am saying, and I'm inviting him to have his voice and to speak. And so that's religion. That's how I imagine the word religion now. To me, the secondary meaning of it is this institution in the past. So I'd like to be able to shift, if possible, to through my work, I'd like to shift that that way of hearing the word even, so that we sense it as something alive and very meaningful.
Well, one of the things about this to take the sense of the encounter and the sense of writing and study being in some ways haunted by ghosts is that you're opening up this possibility for in the practice of one's personal religion and or personal spiritual search to really encounter a kind of other that's not embodied, not an ordinary human being, whether this is an imaginal figure, whether it is a ghost speaking to one through a text, whether it is a god in a temple, whether it is a piece of art that you stumble across in the midst of a sort of ordinary day at the museum that just strikes you as if it's speaking to you. This sort of willingness to open a space where a kind of imaginative figure can be given its own demand its own kind of relationship to you. And I'm very interested in that moment, whether it happens in dream work, whether it happens in travel, whether it happens with the idols that are in one's home. And I'd just like to hear you talk a little bit more about that work that I think Hillman called personifying, where you sort of allow these other figures their own autonomy, because it's by having a relationship with these figures outside of you that you move forward, that you peel off the layers beyond a mere self-oriented kind of exploration.
One way I might enter that is, again, something you mentioned when you started this morning, that when I was doing my studies in religion, I was introduced to the Hermetic tradition, that is the natural magic, and that was very popular in Renaissance Europe. And they often quoted a passage where the suggestion was, it's from a book called The Asclepius, a passage where they said that when an artist is really a good artist and has the right intention and skill, whatever object that artist makes, like a statue or sculpture or painting, when the artist makes that, the spirit or whatever spirit he's trying to evoke will be enticed and will have no choice but to take up residence in that image. And you get the same idea in Japan, you get it in India, where the statue or the piece of art, the work of art, is a home for a spirit. And when you behold or stand in the presence of that image, then you are making yourself accessible to that spirit. So it's like a darshan. It's like a standing in front of the object. It doesn't have to be in India. It could be anywhere, you know, any painting, any sculpture, that you really allow to have its own persona, its own presence, its own soul identity. Then it's not a lifeless object, but rather you are encountering it the way you would a person, and you are affected by that encounter. So that's a very different notion of images than we usually have, because in a modernist way of thinking, images are the creation of their creator, the artist. And to understand what they are, we tend to look at the biography of the artist. This other way is to say that the object, the art object or the statue or idol, as you say, has its own reality, its own personality, and it has something to say to us and something to give to us.
Well, see, that's the very feminine way to look at it, I feel like, because you're describing how you just give something a form, but then that form, the spirit inhabits it, right? So that means as creators, that's the very masculine act of following the creator and making this thing. But in fact, all the goo or the juice or the energy or essence that fills all this stuff up, that's the spirit that enters into the form, right? We kind of think about it, I agree, like you said, we, in my opinion, think about it backwards.
Well, yes, exactly. We get it backwards. And but I think it goes along with our whole, the whole way we think in our society today, which is really so ego-centered, you know, that that we make everything. Anything that you don't make is a projection of yourself. I don't usually use that word projection the way the psychologists do, because what they're saying is that the only real psyche reality is the human ego and subjective awareness. Whereas what I'm suggesting here, following Hillman and others, is that these works of art, when we create them, we are creating something more than just an object, a material thing. We are giving birth to something, or maybe that's the feminine side of it. We are allowing something to come into existence that has a personality and a reality of its own, and our job is to pay heed and respect to that object that's there now.
Yeah, I also love this because it allows one, or again gives permission, for different ways of doing things that we already do as sort of secular people. And I'm thinking just of going to the museum. It's something that most people do at some point. It's just part of a engaged cultural life. And so we're in this modern space of the museum that has this kind of underlying idea of like collection and selection and the experts who organize the objects and write their little descriptions of them, et cetera, et cetera. It's still a very kind of secular space. And yet, with these ideas in mind, one can go in there, especially in my experience when you're alone, and you go, okay, I'm going on a dream walk now. And you just open up and you wander through the space like you're wandering through a dream, and then objects will call. And then you go and you engage that object, and maybe you'll read about it later, but really it's about this kind of encounter. And, I can traipse through, whatever, a great big museum like the Met in New York or whatever, and find all of these objects and then just kind of have these conversations. But I just look like everybody else, and I'm just doing my thing, and then I walk out. It's so different than going in there with, like, I'm going to look at the early Socratic art and get an understanding of how it works. This sort of knowledge-driven way of consuming objects is just fitting them into some kind of intellectual matrix. But it's right there. And you just do that, and it's going to work. I mean, anybody could do that. And that, to me, like some of the things you're talking about, even if the language we're using here, religion, the soul, hermetic, da-da-da, it tends to pull away from just how basic some of the things you're talking about are in terms of practices that we can have in our ordinary lives that help cultivate these kinds of experiences. And I know that that's also important for you, and so the question out of all this is what are some other practices that you suggest, that you talk about in this book or in others, that allow people, or create environments where people can cultivate this deeper relationship to the soul?
Yes, well, there are many others, and probably one of the most important ones for me at this time is the dream work. I have a whole chapter on dream work in it. I hesitate with that because a lot of people talk about dreams in many different ways, but what I wanted to point out was that as part of one's religion, see, I would say that it's what you were describing going to a museum in your own way there and encountering the images and not just studying them. That when you do that, it's a religious practice. I would call that your religious practice. It's not something you had to get from any traditional, church or theology. It's something that you can do yourself, but it is your religion. And I would say the same about dream work. We can reimagine that too, put it in a different context, not as a psychological thing where we're trying to figure ourselves out and be better people, sort of self-improvement. Rather that if you do the dream work carefully, in a similar way to going to the museum, then what you're going to do is encounter this whole world that is part of your world that you don't see very often. You get glimpses of it in dreams. And therefore, you're getting a glimpse of that part of you that is timeless and very profound and influencing your life. And that, to me, would be a very important part of a religious practice or a spiritual practice, either way you want to put that.
Well, I'd love to talk more about dreams, but we're going to take a break right now. We can do that when we come back. You're listening to Eric Davis and Maja Daou on Expanding Mind, and we're talking with Thomas More, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We are talking with Eric Davis, my co-host, and we're here speaking with Thomas More today about how to cultivate your soul and talking about his new book, A Religion of One's Own. And before the break, you were talking a little bit about dream work, which I love that you said that, because a lot of people, I feel like, forget about that you can work with your dreams. A lot, you know, like you said, lots of people write about dreams and they'll try to figure it out and like, what's the symbolic meaning? Why wasn't I, you know, wearing clothes at school or whatever? But they fail to address the aspect that dreams are or can be participatory. And like you said, can kind of join or yoke you to these usually hidden aspects of yourself to allow to sort of have this mirror. And I was wondering if, do you do or would you prescribe mainly lucid dreaming techniques, or does it vary, or do you have like a favorite thing that you do that you could describe to folks?
No, I don't really don't have much of a technique. I don't favor myself lucid dreaming, because in this I follow Hillman, who said it's so important to not to try to make our conscious life influence our dreams, but rather to really let ourselves be affected by our dreams. He wrote a book called Dream in the Underworld, where he says we should not bring dreams up to examine them. We should go down into the dream in order to be affected and, you know, to find things, discover things. So that's my attitude generally to the dream itself. But what I really am interested in relation to A Religion of One's Own is the actual practice of looking at your dreams. I'm doing quite a bit of that work now with, not a lot with many people, but I'm doing a very intense work, therapeutic work with people where we work with dreams exclusively. And what I find is that the dreams do two things. They take us so deep, way beneath any awareness that a person might have of who they are and what's going on. They get to really find their primal stuff, their material, who they are. And the second thing is that the dreams keep us up to date. I mean, the dreams are moving. They seem very related to what's going on at a particular time. They do seem to be circular, so that they return, they keep returning, themes keep returning. On the other hand, they do keep us up to date, and I really like that too. I trust the dream so much, and in my own experience of guiding people this way with the dream work is so satisfying, and it makes me think that maybe the reason a lot of people burn out from their jobs is that they don't go deep enough. If you go deep enough into almost anything, you're going to find such wonderful satisfaction from it that you can't wait for the next time you do it. So I think that this practice of looking at our dreams, I know it's not easy to do, but I think that if you get familiar with images and make those trips to the museums, you'll get to know images more, and the dreams will become clearer more easily, and you'll find those secrets of who you are. It'd be definitely worth it.
It seems like another thing that these practices are designed to do, and I know you talk about a number of other things in your book, including, you know, tarot cards and paying attention to synchronicity and a variety of practices that kind of are the meat of this religion of one's own. And the part of the thing that's uniting a lot of them is the creating situations where one can discover mystery or face what one doesn't know or be challenged or be forced to respond to something that's outside of your control, outside of your knowledge, something that's transcendent or mysterious. And this strikes me as one thing that's particularly sort of insidious about our moment. I you know, love the internet in many ways, and you know, I've been very interested in the development of technology and its relationship to the soul. But one of the downsides of it, I think, is a culture. What I think of as a culture of knowingness, where it's very easy to get to amass a lot of knowledge very quickly. And we're also doing that in an environment that is absolutely stuffed to the gills with experts, self-styled experts. So in anything you want to figure out and discover, you know, from like juicing fast to the Trilateral Commission to, you know, how to cultivate your garden, anything you go, any direction you go, it's, there's already like 1,000 experts clamoring to tell you the way to do it. And between these two things, the ease of access of knowledge and the being surrounded by experts, it becomes very difficult to regularly have a space that you can kind of trust the encounter with the unknown, with what is not known, which no one knows, or the ignorance that can only speak to you, or the not knowing that can only speak to you. That genuine sense of mystery, which forces a response, which leads us down into the underworld or into a more creative life. And that also, I'm kind of curious, like, do you see that as a sort of a threatened part of human consciousness and human culture today? That even the capacity to think that mysteries are good things, that it's good that there's a mystery that we'll never solve. Do you see that as a kind of threatened thing? Is part of the goal with your work to sort of keep that space for mystery open?
Certainly. I think that's the essence of religion. When I think of a definition of religion, probably the best one for me is any creative and concrete response to the mysteries that we confront in our regular everyday lives. And if you're not aware of the mystery, then you're probably going to be stuck in a secular life, which is a soulless place to be. And it's like living on the surfaces. It's not satisfying. I think that's why so many people are aimless and depressed. They really don't know anything about their depths. You know, we don't have any way of getting to them. Religion ought to do that, but the religious, formal religion has not done that at all. As far as it goes, most formal religions have been part of that same culture. So we have to find a way to respect and honor the mystery. And you find this in all the traditions still. I mean, I'm enforced by that with reading the Tao Te Ching regularly. I mean, you know, that's an encouragement to stay close to the mystery. And the mystics of most religions encourage that kind of thing. One of my favorite Christian theologians is Nicholas of Cusa, who had a mystical experience where he discovered the importance of not knowing, and he sat down and wrote a book called On Cultivating Ignorance. And he refers to it as ignorantia sacra, or holy ignorance.
I was just going to say it's such a good word to describe it, as that ignorance or not knowing, because that has such a, it's really hilarious, because people find that to be such a bad trait to have. Like, if you're wandering around like a fool, right, and don't know anything that's going to happen, usually people in society or cultures would think you're stupid, and that is like the exact wrong thing you should do. But consistently in every culture and tradition, and, you know, certainly religious or shamanic history, that's like the most important thing to be able to do, is to reach that point of realizing that you have no idea what's going on. And hey, if you can realize that, you can actually begin to perceive what is really happening.
Yes, I think we have to find out how to do that ourselves in our own context here, you know, in our own ordinary, simple lives. So for me, what it means, what this has meant, is that I can constantly say I don't know without feeling too bad about it. I mean, I feel some inferiority. Yesterday, someone kept asking me, have you read this book? Do you know this author? And I think that she asked me maybe 15 of these things, and I kept saying no. I tried not to get too inferior, you know, feel too inferior, but I finally couldn't help it. I just sunk pretty low because I hadn't heard of anything. I didn't know anything. But then, of course, in the back of my mind, I realized that this is my practice. I know this, that I have to let that happen and to cultivate that ignorance. And that's the way it shows up. It's not going to be like some great meditation where you discover this wonderful ignorance. It's more the inferior feeling of, you know, I don't know so much. I mean, there's so many things I don't know. How could it be? I went to school so long, and I've read and read, and I still don't know. That kind of not knowing is very simple and ordinary, and I think it's valuable. So you see what I'm saying is that the religious aspects of this then are quite ordinary. That's why when I write in a kind of a simple way that bothers some of the experts and the theologians. They don't like my work because it isn't so exalted. I do that purposely because I think that's where it's at. Our ignorance is not some wonderful thing that you can discover in a great chapel in the, you know, in China. It's something you find in the, you know, when you're having lunch with somebody and they're asking if you know something and you have to say no.
Yeah, I remember it became a practice for me, you know, being a straight A student and went to an Ivy League and, you know, got brought up in the sense of just the value of knowledge. I would notice, I think a lot of people do this. They do it for different reasons, but I would often, when I was younger, pretend knowledge that I didn't have. Oh, yeah, I've heard of that. Well, actually, I didn't. And it started to really bother me. And so I really used, like, watching myself do that, watching the impulse, and then, like, forcing myself at sometimes to go, no, I don't know, even though it was like, oh, God, you could have just not said anything. You're admitting it, da, 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 and really going through that. And it still vexes me in the same way you're talking about. But I also realize on the other side of that is something very very intimate and very cool, that sort of the beginner's mind thing that Shunryo Suzuki talks about is right there available in kind of ordinary, you know, ordinary not knowing. There's another part of your book that I really liked when you're talking about how some people give you grief for being a little too simple and that there should be, you know, more heavy guns theology and that it's too close to the ordinary in a way. As you were talking about listing some practices that are helpful for cultivating soul, the I Ching and tarot cards are kind of obvious examples. And you were like, those are cool, I like them. But the one that I really liked, the quote unquote superstitious practice that you were really into is tea leaves, which is not something that I hear about very often. And even in the kind of hierarchy of occult practices is kind of down there, you know? So tell me about how you discovered, like, the interest or just tea leaves and that being a place where you could find these resonances and these invitations.
Well, first of all, I explained that I did my dissertation on natural magic. So I've read about all these people who are finding methods of looking into the world, looking into things in a way that is very different from normal approaches to knowledge. And so I'm always alert to methods. So I try the I Ching and I try tarot cards. And I found that when I did both of those things, I was just being the scholar again. You know, I kept interpreting the images and I figured that's not going to work. And then I remembered that my grandmother used to read tea leaves. And I'm, you know, very close to Ireland, and I spent a lot of time over there. So it was really when I was in Ireland that I got interested in the tea leaves again. And I tried them out, and I was really astonished. I mean, it took a while. You know, I had to try it out. Not too long, but I had to make a few, half a dozen, you know, attempts first. And then I realized I put my face right in that cup and look at those tea leaves and talk to people from what I was seeing in them, not interpreting, but just speaking for the cup in a way. And it was amazing what came out, the valuable things that came out of it. And then I went from there. I still do tea leaves because I like them very much. But then I went to the mirror of that John Dee used to use, and I saw his mirror at the British Museum, and it inspired me to get my own mirror. And now I use the mirror as my primary method. It's a black obsidian mirror. it's a little tricky. It's not as easy as tea leaves to get to know, but I have found it very, very effective. And so in our family now, when we are planning something, we often consult the mirror. And it's not really a spooky kind of thing. It's not fortune-telling or anything, but it's a way of getting out of that rational place. And we get a lot of creative ideas from it and a lot of thoughts about future. That's another thing, too, that I think is something we've lost, that it's been formal religion, and that is a sense of prophecy. I think we need a sense of prophecy.
It's so amazing because those techniques that you're describing, like I said, they fall in line with your whole philosophy, of course, hilariously enough, is that you're not the artist, like, making it be a thing, right? When you do tea leaves or the scrying, as opposed to tarot and I Ching already have a form, right? Like you said, there's already the pictures on the page, then you're left to go at it the backwards way, right? But with tea leaves or scrying, there's no form present. So the actual trick that you're doing is allowing the form to unfold, and then you see kind of what reality is. And I feel so strongly that, like you said, the prophecy that we're missing in the world is because everybody's already ascribed a form to things and think they know what's going on, and they cannot prophesy because they're not paying attention to what's really happening.
Yeah, so to really do this, and actually in order to really get into this religion of your own too, or soul work, I think we have to do is, you really have to be dumb. I mean, you have to be able to have the capacity to be in that state where you're not being so smart and trying to conquer the world with your intelligence. You know, I mean, you have to, I think in the background you have to have some intelligence and study and all that, but when it comes down to it, you really have to go through the world with your eyes sort of half open and stumbling around, bumping into each other, and making mistakes, taking risks, all of that. And then what you find is that you're right on the edge of life then. You discover how in the past, maybe by trying to understand and figure everything out, you've been actually protecting yourself from life.
This also seems to square with the role of intuition, which is another one of those words or concepts that can seem very exalted, kind of esoteric. And yet, again, it's a very ordinary thing. We have opportunity all throughout our days where there's these little impulses, and, you know, you never know. It might be wrong, et cetera, but there's definitely... I think a real case to be made for cultivating intuition, even with the risks that it entails, that maybe sometimes you're wrong and you actually blow it by following a gut instinct rather than rationally processing the possibilities. And these days there's so much rational processing of decisions that our machines are doing it. We're being encouraged to do it, to use apps to make the most efficient decision, to use technologies to try to figure out exactly the best, most likely outcome of any given decision. And as that happens, we miss this opportunity for gut intuition, for gut feeling, like, oh, I should just talk to that person. You know, I walked by a guy yesterday, and there's a lot of people who I pass as I jog or walk up in the mountain right beside my apartment. But I could tell that this guy, I was going to take my headphones off, and I was going to, like, walk slowly because we were going to have a conversation. And we did. He was this old man. It was a really nice conversation. And just those tiny little very humble kind of opportunities for intuition. But that kind of intuition, when you build it up, is related to this question of prophecy.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So it's not so exalted. When you were talking there, I was thinking that my family uses a name for me that is I like a lot. They call me Mr. Magoo. the guy who keeps walking into things and can't see and doesn't know what's going on around him. And I like that because it's so much better than the word like guru, but I think they probably mean something very similar. You know, in other words, the best way to be in this world where you are really in touch with what's happening in it is to not be so alert all the time. You know, and to maybe develop even a persona that is somewhat here and not here at the same time, you know, to cultivate that. That's, to me, that's been valuable. I mean, that doesn't take much cultivation on my part because it just happens all the time. I'm always forgetting things and making mistakes and getting the, you know. So when that happens, if I can just make a part of this persona, I find that very liberating, and I find it very much in tune with what would be my religion.
One thing that just popped in my head as you were describing that, just making another connection with a topic that's important to you and the Hillman work that we haven't really talked about, is the whole relationship to the shadow. And again, we could blow it up into this whole big thing, the darkness, the dragons, and da-da-da. But in a way, allowing oneself to be fuzzy is sort of allowing a very ordinary kind of shadow into your ordinary life, where you're not awake and alert all the time. You're not always in the rhetoric of light, where it's about clarity, it's about perception, it's about, you know, attention, that there's also a kind of shadow in the mind, in the ordinary mind, as it kind of bumbles through its day, because in the shadow you stumble across things and suddenly the world is larger. So there is a sort of shadowed side of that as well. We don't have a lot of time left, but I would love to hear you just talk a little bit about what the role of the shadow or the dark side or the difficult, the painful, even the nightmarish plays in this religion of one's own.
Well, if you look at shadow, there are many different ways of many different kinds of shadow and all of that, but let's say the imperfection of life, the things in yourself that you never get right, or that you wish that you could become more aware of, the mistakes that you always make. These things are really part of who we are. I mean, they are really essential. Without that, you probably would succumb to some kind of feeling of health and normality that would destroy your soul. I've never liked the idea of pushing health quite as hard as we do. The most soulful people I've ever met are very unhealthy, usually, in one way or another. So I don't think that kind of that super perfect human being is at all the ideal for the soulful life. And that's because we can allow shadow into it. The shadow, sometimes shadow is very something very simple, sometimes it's quite serious. But I know for myself that the important thing for me in relation to shadow is to just let it be. You were saying before you have a tendency to defend, you know, like to right away say, you know, that, oh, actually, I've never read that book, but it's on my list, you know, something like that. I think if we can just be quiet and allow the shadow to be there, it gives us this fog that's so important. Another thing I wanted to say that just in fun that came up as we were talking, a lot of people today talk about be here now. I usually say be there then. You know, I mean, I really like the past. I like living in the past. I usually only read books written in the past. I feel like I really belong 500 years back somewhere. And living in the past, I think, is a good way to get into soul. And Jung did that by building his Bollingen Tower in that way. So living in the past, not being too smart about everything that goes on, but at the same time, the person who's able to do that, live in the mist instead of in the light, if you're able to do that, you also can have room for real intelligence. So you keep studying, and I'm not suggesting being literally dumb. I'm suggesting being literally smart and read and be intelligent, but have a persona that is more like Mr. Magoo.
I like that part of what you're talking about is, we just say have just a couple minutes left, but it is about creating a persona, that it's not just about what you do in your private space, in your internal space, in the space of like the authenticity of your own subjective experience, that part of this work is also about how to be in the world in a certain way and even create a persona that allows certain things to happen and prevents other things from happening. Just a totally banal example of precisely what you're talking about, the Mr. Magoo style, is that I have a intentionally lackadaisical approach to cell phones. Like, you text me, I might respond, I might not, I might not give me a voicemail, I might respond, I might not, so that everybody learns that I'm not that fast. And it creates this kind of smoke screen around me that allows me to kind of fumble through and not always be responding to data all the time. And it's a great gift, you know, a little bit of the Mr. Magoo. Well, we only have a couple minutes left. Anything more about how you're, what you discovered from this book that was new for you, given how many works you've written, how long you've been thinking about these things? What's the freshest motivating notion right now for you?
Well, I guess what sticks out most for me is what we've just been talking about, that that I now can write a book where I can just enjoy writing the sentences and the paragraphs and trying to make something beautiful and trust beauty. You know, I keep going back to Keats and beauty is truth. In regard to also to what you just said about authenticity, that word struck me because you'll never find that word in my books. I try not to be authentic, you know. I think that's asking way too much. So if I can go along and even when talking about this book, I want to present an idea to people, but I'm not interested in saying this is what everyone should do. I'm not a missionary about it. I put this out there, and if we can enjoy a conversation like we've had today, that's really what's most important.
Well, wonderful. Thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you.
All right. From Eric and Maja to all you out there, keep your minds open.